Come, thou almighty King, help us thy name to sing. Help us to praise. Father, all glorious, o'er all victorious, come and reign over us, Ancient of Days. To thee, great one in three, the highest praises be. Hence, evermore, thy sovereign majesty may we in glory see, and through eternity love and adore. Amen. I want first to bid the heartiest welcome I know how to voice or give to those students who are returning and to the new students who have come with us for the first time. And just as heartily would I welcome the generous sprinkling of guests whom I see with us this morning. I trust that those who are visiting will visit often and that you will always feel at home here in the chapel for any service we may have here. Likewise, at home on the campus in general to the use of our library, cafeteria, whatever facilities can be of real service to you. It is an especial pleasure to me to come to this 10th convocation, the 10th year of operation of Southeastern Seminary. Sometimes through those years I've wondered if I'd live to see it, and sometimes I've wondered if I would be permitted by Baptists in general to see the 10th year of operation here. And my heart truly does leap up with inner joy as I am privileged to be here with so many of you. May God bless us not only in this hour, but in a special way may his blessings be upon us throughout this 10th year of operation. I think that for my own heart and mind, no guest could be more welcome than the pleasant and wonderful man who comes to us for the opening convocation. 5 years ago, Dr. Blackburn, who was then pastor of the Baptist Church here in Wake Forest, and I traveled together to the meeting of the Baptist World Alliance in London. And on the boat going over, we had the privilege of coming to know Dr. and Mrs. Miller. I hardly know which one I cherish more. I enjoyed both of them so much then, and treasure the fact that they have not forgotten those days and are not ashamed to consort still with Southerners and sinners. And they happily received the invitation and accepted it and are both here with us yesterday afternoon, today, and for a little while tomorrow morning. Dr. Miller is Dean of the Harvard Divinity School. That is, I suppose, the primary thing right now about him. He was a poor boy like many of us who struggled for his education in New Jersey, Philadelphia, on up to Colgate, and then became a pastor of several church after church in New Jersey for a while, but settled about 1935. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, and until last year was pastor. Tell me the name, that slips me right.
Old Cambridge Baptist.
Old Cambridge, I knew it had something ancient about it, but I couldn't. Old Cambridge Baptist Church, just at the campus of Harvard University. And for about 25 years, you see, he ministered there in a way that shone out among Baptists and among all others who knew about him and the church. I think that the finest thing most any Baptist has ever done was to write the book, The Life of the Soul, and that other one which I personally cherish still more, The Great Realities. There are two books that are almost constantly by my bedside, at least they're immediately at hand in the shelf facing my desk. One is The Human Situation by McNeil Dixon, and the other is The Great Realities by Samuel H. Miller. I know that you will enjoy reading, when you can read, these books that he has written. We will enjoy hearing him today. And with all my heart, and I believe I can say with all our Southern Baptist hospitality at its finest and best, we welcome Dr. Samuel H. Miller, who will speak to us now on the topic, Souls Threshed from Their Husks. Dr. Miller.
President Staley, members of the faculty, and students of Southeastern Seminary. It's rather difficult to do any better in responding to this most cordial and extremely embarrassing introduction. If Dr. Staley was surprised that I would have anything still to do with Baptists and sinners in the South, perhaps a Harvard man would be surprised that anybody in the South would have anything to do with him. I hope that both of us are, first of all, human beings, and then, secondly, Christians, and perhaps in such dimensions of our friendship and love for each other, there may be found an explanation of why we enjoy seeing one another. I bring you the felicitations of the Divinity School on this 10th anniversary. We are so much older and so much smaller that it seems a bit pretentious of us to attempt to congratulate a school whose success and obvious rewards in the kingdom have been so plainly visible as yours. We hope that this will continue to bring great joy and satisfaction not only to those who are laboring so heavily in the work of these years of founding or establishing the school, but equally to the students who are profiting so much from the work being done here. The phrase which I have suggested for the title of this address or lecture is taken from William Blake. Stars and souls threshed from their husks. I must confess I don't know what William Blake meant exactly when he said that stars might be threshed from their husks, but I have seen souls threshed from their husks. I have seen souls put under the burning flame and left shining for having been delivered of all the unreality and alloy in their nature. I have seen souls under the heavy flail of brutal adversity come clean, stripped of all their poses and mock hypocrisies, and become genuine. I have seen souls under the searing flame of suffering become pure and single-minded. I have seen souls under the probing steel of pain become mature, strong, courageous. I have seen souls come into possession of themselves and know who they were. And I suspect that William Blake meant simply that men and women were normally born into a world so full of freedom for the human venture that many times we chose paths, vocations, even relationships with other people in which we did not know how to substantiate that which we had begun. We were cursed by unrealities, by the poses that did not mean anything to us, by too many faces which we wore, in which our hearts were not completely and adequately expressed. One can understand something of this when he looks at his own life, a long search for one's own self, to be oneself and not the shadow of somebody else, to be able to speak with genuine sincerity, with obvious substance, with a certain weight and specific gravity when he said the word I, and to mean I and not another. Carl Sandburg, when he had finished his great work on Abraham Lincoln, was asked by a friend, what are you going to do now? And he said, I should like to find out who this guy Carl Sandburg is. All our lives we are trying to find out who we are, to become ourselves, to strip off the unrealities, the excess baggage, the poses in which we do not live, even the vocations in which we act but are not concerned, sometimes the activities which exhaust us but which mean nothing to us. It is a long and mysterious venture. The human being is both cursed and glorified by this seeking for self-identity. A lion is a lion, is never more nor less a beast, but a man is sometimes himself and sometimes not himself. As Jean-Paul Sartre put it, human beings are never quite themselves, they're always a little bit behind or a little bit ahead of themselves. A little bit less than what they would like to be, sometimes playing at being more than they really are. To be threshed from the husks is really the concern indicated by fiction from the time of the Greek dramatists to our own. Look at Oedipus, a great king, a fine engineer, a good administrator, an esteemed citizen. And then through the process of self-knowledge and confession and the brutal impingement of all kinds of circumstances, he is forced, as Jean Cocteau has put it, to become something more than a cardboard king. All these external layers are slowly but surely pushed away until at last the cardboard king becomes a man. Or in our own time, Hemingway, telling the story of the old man and the sea, the fisherman who goes out farther than he ever went before, seeking a larger fish than he ever caught before. Until in this ordeal, all the layers, all the external husks are divested, and at last he becomes himself in a great struggle with the elements of the universe. And then, though he never brings back much to show for it, in that agony, he has become that which was always hidden by little failures, petty successes, ordinary activities and commonplace events. One of the dreadful things about our world is the tendency for it to dehumanize humanity. We become mere functions of our jobs. We are involved in a mad rush, a rat race, a squirrel cage. We have jobs in certain great organizations, and the jobs are bigger than we are, or they are on an assembly line, or in a great organization in such a way that we lose our identity, and we merely are the handles for tools, the switches for power, the transporters of means to ends which we cannot see. When Franz Kafka told the story of a salesman and said that one morning he woke up in bed, stretched himself, and then looked, and suddenly with sick realization knew himself to be no longer human, but some kind of a cockroach with black legs sticking in the air, unable to get off his back. He was telling something of that nausea which overcomes modern man when he knows himself no longer to be himself, but merely an addendum, an appendage, something attached to the machinery of the world, no longer having a soul. Now, this introduction is for the purpose of saying to you this morning that I believe that the prime urgency of the ministry in the 20th century, when men and women are inwardly bewildered and outwardly confused, is to be a person, a full person, a total person, a person with weight, with substance, with poise, with stability. This does not mean with rigidity. It is not to be a frozen statue of stone in the whirling traffic of the world. It is rather to be a man standing in all the bewilderment and anxiety, fears, and worries of the modern world, with a sense that within his own soul there is a counterbalance. He himself has been stripped of all the unrealities of the current world, and he stands in those eternal verities, able to see the world, able to feel it, but no longer a slave to it. He has been stripped of its illusion, burned down to solid core, no longer a mere conglomeration of layers, as Peer Gynt once put it of himself, lacking an inner kernel. But to be a person is the most serious and most difficult thing. To be oneself and not somebody else. To have a message that comes from one's own experience and not merely from books or from the echoes of great men. To be in that core of reality where life is so vigorous, so dynamic, so utterly itself, that when one speaks of I, one hears ringing all the dimensions of the ages. How it would have been good to have heard Socrates standing with a cup of hemlock saying, I. How good, powerful, and awful it would have been to hear the might of that man's ego, Napoleon, say, I. How tremendous it to have heard the I of Jesus, a man stripped of all illusions, but burning, shining like shook foil in a world of confusion and bewilderment, saying, I am the truth. Come unto me, ye that labor and are heavy laden, exhausted, weary, bored, and I will give you rest. The prime duty of theological education is to strip you of your unrealities, illusions, poses, frozen stances, and to elicit from you that which God placed in you at the center of your life, and which unfortunately in this world tends constantly to be covered up, smothered, underneath all kinds of extraneous activity. Theological education is to bring a man to maturity so that he can stand in this bewildering traffic of the contemporary world with poise, unshaken by it, untempted in it, and stable in spite of it. It is indeed one of the great embarrassments of contemporary Protestant theological education that for the most part we must leave the individual to produce the disciplines by which this maturity is fulfilled. Other churches may have their methods, but the Protestant stands so much on his own feet. He is so self-reliant. Indeed, he becomes so independent and rebellious against all authority of any kind whatsoever that at last he tends to think that his papal individuality is the same as the speaking of the Spirit. It is hard in Protestant theological education to produce a program in which the disciplines are such that men and women will go through great crises in which they will slough off unreal and illusory portions of their own extraneous life to come down to the core of being themselves and capable of representing the most real of all real things in the world, God, the most real of all human beings, Jesus, the Son of God. How shall we achieve such maturity? How shall we handle this mystery of what we are? How shall we come to realize what we are by sloughing off what we are not? Are there any ways by which we can gird about us certain disciplines or habits by which education is insinuated and becomes an inner reality so that we are educated from the inside out and do not become merely the stalking horses of a great encyclopedic information without ever touching the core of our own reality? I think there are some indications of how men do become themselves, how their souls are threshed from husks. Years ago, I read a book and saw the movie of Annapurna, the great mountain of the Himalayas, climbed by a few men. Why does anyone set himself against such a wild, massive, powerful adversary as a mountain like Annapurna? Suffer himself to be frozen, his fingers to fall off, his own life to be cast into a crucible of suffering just to climb it. Yet, as one saw the movie and read the book, one sensed that these men were men, anxious to be stripped of all illusions, to test their strength against some greatness that would elicit all the greatness that was within them. And in that test, find themselves as they could not find themselves in all the padded layers of comfort and prestige. Certainly this comes over one as he looks at the life of Bonhoeffer, studying in a theological seminary here in the United States when the Nazi rise to power frightened everybody in the world. And the ways opened so that Dietrich Bonhoeffer might have stayed in this country and studied and become a distinguished professor of theology in one of our own schools. And yet, even as a student, he wrote back to Reinhold Niebuhr and Paul Lehmann, "I cannot do this. The lines are drawn in Germany, and though it means my life, I must stand where I was born and raised, in the church from whence I secured my sense of God's grace. And there, if need be, cast my life in the balance. I cannot stay away from the confusion where decisions are necessary." This man took his life and put it up against the vastness and greatness of a crisis, and all the greatness of his own soul was elicited. He became great because he lived in relationship to a crisis. I know of no substitute for this. There are certain ways by which ministers avoid that in which their greatness might be elicited. There is a temptation to pick up the programs and the activities and the techniques and the extraneous, superficial machinery of the church, plunge into it headlong, and make a great success of it. And in all the doing, there is little being. Or there is the possibility that a man may become very smooth, professionally skillful and suave, skirt all the questions, be prudent in the midst of great issues, and at last always say the right thing everywhere, every time, without ever uncovering the quivering quick of his own soul. No, if a man wants to find the greatness in himself, if he wants to find what he is himself, it will be necessary to measure himself against some kind of greatness somewhere. How shall any man go into the ministry and not feel the inexplicable mystery of human existence every day? Day of life. How can a man minister to a congregation who does not feel within his own soul the swinging tides of life and death, the awful abyss that lies beneath every human being, who sees the agony and ordeal of love and shame, who has not sensed what it means to take his own life in his hands, anybody's life, and ask what it is, why he was born in such a time as this, grew up in the loneliness of adolescence, fell in love, married, had these children, suffered embarrassment, grew anxious, fearful, tragedy fell, and things that could not be explained, resolved, where there were no easy answers. This greatness, this mystery of existence, this fact that there are no answers for some things that happen in life, no easy answers, only the measuring of Oedipus against the abyss, only the measuring of the mountain climber against the awful ordeal of the summit, only the measuring of Jesus Christ on the cross and of his disciples on Jesus Christ. To avoid this leaves a man with many layers, but no core.
with much prestige, but no substance.
A friend of mine not long ago said, I would like to go to church, but it's the one place in the modern world where I cannot ask the great questions. If this is true, it is a tragic truth. This is where
the questions of Adam and Eve, or of Cain, am I my brother's keeper? Or of Job, where art thou? I go forward and I cannot find thee, and backward and thou art not there, to the right and I cannot see thee, and to the left and thou art absent. This is where a great soul will say, darkness was not cut off from my face when I was born, and it is still there before my face. This is where men say, as Jesus Christ once said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? This is the only place in the world where a man dare ask the questions that elsewhere have no answers.
To be measured against the mystery of human existence, to keep that mystery in mind with every knowledge that we have, with every doctrine we know, with every interpretation of help, with every resource of the gospel, is to remain alive. I suppose this is essentially what I would mean by living at the edge redemptively, at the growing edge. Somehow or other, there are two courses in the ministry. One becomes more and more acquainted with the necessary mechanics of dealing with people in such a way that one never touches the fundamental mystery of their lives. One can do this adroitly with a very skillful manipulation and find it very successful. The other is to stand in that awful sanctuary where both the minister and his church member stand silent in God's presence and have nothing to say but are equally blessed. To live at the growing edge, to live at that edge where God's revelations are coming into life, to be able to do as Bob Norwood once did as a young minister in a little shack on the coast of Labrador, sitting all night with a fisherman while his wife died in the next room, hearing her anguished breathing and the crying of the baby to which she had just given birth, knowing that death was coming for one before dawn, and to sit at the kitchen table where the oilcloth lapped over the edges and the coffee cup still sat undrunk, and Bob Norwood said his eyes looked down and he saw the two shoes, those old-fashioned high-laced shoes that Labradorian women wore and went down over the shingle of the coast to scan the waves and see whether their husbands were coming in from the fishing or not. Those shoes would never be worn again. All the mystery of life and death were there. All the strange grace and compassion of God's mercy was there. And Bob Norwood said, the whole Bible, the life and death and resurrection of Jesus Christ shone out of a pair of old shoes. To live where you see the common things of life burning with a glory that only the eyes of faith can see. To be waiting for the Lord. Waiting for the Lord not in some clouds of supernal power, but to wait for the Lord in those commonplaces where a glass of cold water is given,
or a child's eyes twinkle with joy, or an old man is grateful for forgiveness. To live at the growing edge, redemptively,
to live quietly, to live patiently, waiting for these things that crowd our living day, but which for the most part we never see
because we're in such a mad rush. To live as few men live, with the poise and the stability
of the great realities of the gospel, knowing that the world can neither give nor take away what can be found in this humble, quiet, patient world. There is greatness here. Do not mistake it. When the Beatitudes are spoken, blessed are the poor in spirit. And most of us feel that this is strange and mysterious because all of us believe that blessed are the aggressive, the powerful, the ambitious. They get somewhere. Blessed are the meek. And over against that, our contemporary world where people think they get somewhere by being successful instead of meek. Blessed are the pure in heart, the single-minded, those who wait to see the miracle of the old shoes, as over against those who are distracted by distraction from distraction, with a multitude of committees to meet, and 1,001 activities in which they do not put their heart, but only their hands and their time. Oh, the Beatitudes have nothing to do with happiness. The Beatitudes are a whole world above happiness. God isn't concerned whether you're happy or not, but he's concerned with whether you're blessed or not. There is a blessing beyond happiness, beyond comfort, beyond prestige, far beyond success. It is better to be great in the mystery of that greatness that comes in the kingdom of God than it is to be a success in the ways of the world, where we number it in statistics and influence and comfort and prestige and possessions. No matter how you try, the agony of your soul will always come to the surface in those crises when you will be forced to answer not what you think other people think, but when you will be forced to answer out of what you are and what you think, love and death and shame, where you must stand single in God's judgment and your souls are threshed of all their husks. It will take a long time, all your life, to be yourself. When Beethoven finished his 9th symphony and put one of those great motifs in that break the heavens open and shine a glory on us that we cannot possibly express, it was only because from his earliest years he had labored patiently with a phrase of music. When I mentioned that ninth symphony to a musical friend of mine at Harvard, he said, "Didn't you know that he used that 18 other times in his life? 18 times when he thought he had his hands on it. Another time, but Beethoven was great that he did not seem satisfied with a little success. He knew the little successes were failures. And it wasn't until as an old man, deaf, that he finally uttered that which gathered up his whole soul. You will not be yourself today or tomorrow or 10 years from now. It will take a lifetime.
But in the moment of your death, you will be only yourself and nothing else. And I pray, God, that it will be a great death, a death in which you shall have measured yourself against it with such magnitude, transcending all the little petty skills and shrewdnesses of life, in which you had measured yourself against the eternal verities and darknesses and agonies of spirit, so that you might be like St. Francis, able to sing the moment of your transfiguration. Even Jesus said, "Whom do men say that I am? What do you think I am?" The answer to that is really in the next chapter, where standing on the mountain, he was transfigured, became himself, and came down to know who he was and what he was to do, in all modesty and humility, to be a servant of the All-High God. Thank you.
We do thank you.